Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone. This is Carol Harnett. I'm the president of the Council for Disability Awareness, and you're joining our regular podcast, which is called the Financial Health and Income Network. Our topic today, I think, is incredibly interesting for several reasons. We're going to be talking today about the connections among sleep, mental health, and being absent from work, what some of us in the disability insurance arena would call disability. And so why this is particularly interesting for me today is while I am normally a wonderful sleeper, I have basically come off a night where I had a series of naps, of which I finally woke up from and got out of bed from around 3:30 this morning. And as I was reading the New York Times on my phone, it turns out that today, and we are live recording this show, today is Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. Today, the New York Times has done a pretty elaborate piece on sleep, and they opens with a statistic specific to the pandemic, which I think is interesting. And their statistic is that in July of last year, so in July of 2020, 20% of Americans reported that they experienced insomnia. And when they compared it to a second solicitation of the same question in March of 2021, 60% of Americans now report bouts of insomnia. So couldn't possibly be better timing. Now, joining me today are two people I actually know very well. One is Fred Schott. He is a colleague of mine at the Council for Disability Awareness, and he is our Director of Operations and Research. And we also have joining with us a member of the CDA board, Ian Bridgman. Ian is the Executive Director of the Claim Lab, which I will headline as an organization that does data analysis, particularly on disability claims, largely with carriers. You can find out more about Fred and Ian in the show notes for this show. So I want to just get right into it because I want to make the most of our time together. So my little headline for my introduction to sleep as a topic was really probably about 10 to 15 years ago. I used to speak quite a bit about American adults' health, their weight, their fitness, their wellness. And one of the things I spent time on was the impact of sleep on physical health, and specifically because 15 years ago, obesity was a rising epidemic, and people were very curious as to drivers. And one of the things that I know as a physiologist by training is that if someone does not have a good night's sleep, one of the first things they do when they wake up is crave carbohydrates. It's the body's way of trying to replenish itself and some of the hormones that it needs to function well, which is often the etiology of why we have breakfasts that are often very carbohydrate intensive, breads and oatmeals and things along those nature. I know my colleague Fred has an interest in this topic of this intersection of sleep, not only with mental health, but physical health. So Fred, I know you've been spending some time learning more about those things. Why don't you share with us what's captured your attention?
Yeah, thanks, Carol. This is a great topic. And I guess there in the last couple of months, there are two webinars, if you will, that I kind of tuned into on the topic of sleep that really had some great information in there. And I'll get the links and we can share them in the show notes here. But there was one a couple of months ago that did a good overview from, you know, an employer perspective. Why should employers be concerned about sleep and sleep hygiene in the workplace? And there was a lot of, you know, focus in that on sleep and sleeplessness and the impact on productivity, cognitive function, attention, and in particular for workplaces that are particularly, you know, safety sensitive on safety impacts. So there was, you know, some powerful information there. It was the guest speaker was an academic researcher, a sleep specialist, the founding editor of one of the peer-reviewed journals on sleep medicine. Really good informative material in there. But what was kind of clear was, and she also addressed from, you know, the physical health point of view, you know, not just the, you know, poor sleep over time can result in, you know, increased cardiovascular issues, increased risk of, you know, diabetes and other factors. And also to your point about the obesity cycle, the it can mess up your leptin and ghrelin hormonal cycles. And I guess leptin being the hormone that suppresses your appetite, ghrelin being the one that increases your appetite. And guess what? You know, when you have sleeplessness, you get less of the hormone that makes you less hungry and more of the hormone that makes you hungry. So, you know, it's a perfect storm in that function. So, you know, there's the physical, physical health, there's the cognitive functioning, but there's also, you know, increasing just the mental health aspects. Clearly some, you know, research showing a link between, you know, depression and borderline ADHD and lack of sleep. So what I found very fascinating is that, you know, this is a phenomenon that kind of spans so many of these areas that we're concerned about. And in this second webinar that I watched just, you know, about a week ago or so, the director of the Sleep Research Center at University of Arizona made the point that this is one of those, you know, all-encompassing health behaviors. It's right up there along with things like, you know, diet, exercise, and the like, cutting across so many aspects of your life where sleep is, you know, is foundational. And he said something to the effect of, if you address somebody's sleep issues, you can solve so many of their other health and productivity issues. So that was my takeaway from that. And then also, you know, from the first webinar, they had a series of book titles. They said, if you want to do a book club on sleep, then, you know, here's some recommended titles. And one of them was a book by Arianna Huffington. And I tell you, you know, say what you will about Arianna Huffington and, you know, the model she set up for her website and the like, but, you know, she has definitely been on the cutting edge of a lot of health issues. And she was onto this quite a few years before it became more mainstream. So, yeah, I see stuff like that and I sit up and take notice. But what's kind of interesting is, you know, mentioning all of this stuff in the course of conversations with Ian, I got some really, you know, fascinating insights from Ian on some work he's been doing on the front of, you know, sleep-related issues and disability claims. So, you know, we were actually going to write about this. We decided it might be a better topic to handle as a podcast. So that's, you know, that's where Ian comes in.
That's a great overview, Fred. And if you don't mind, I'm going to pitch Ian a question for a second, and then I'll certainly let you interview him as well and go back and forth. So Ian, you know, we're fascinated with what you've been doing in claim analysis and claim inquiries through questionnaires about how did you choose sleep and how did you stumble on it and what are you finding? And that's a really big question. But how did you just even start down this road?
Well, yeah, okay. Thanks, Carol. Thanks, Fred. I mean, it is a very interesting topic. And I wish I could say it was part of our strategy to research sleep, but of course it wasn't. We as you say, we stumbled into it. And about 3 years ago, we started collecting data on sleep through the work we do with our psychosocial questionnaires. We basically try and identify what other complication factors there might be in trying to get someone back to work who's got a disability condition, a disabling condition. And so we ask the question about sleep. You know, do you get an uninterrupted night's sleep? You know, and on a scale of 1 to 5. And so we started looking at this data, and we've got a few hundred to a thousand claims in. We started to do correlations on it, and of course we saw there was a huge correlation between lack of sleep and a poor mental well-being. I suppose, you know, anyone with a young family knows that there's no surprise there, is there? But actually, what we then subsequently found out, and oh, by the way, I have to say, unlike Carol, I am a member of the Sleepless Nightclub. So this is a, this is something which I'm personally very passionate about. But of course, what we then learned was, of course, that major depression and sleep are irrevocably intertwined. And in actual fact, inability to sleep is one of the key determinants of a diagnosis of major depression. So, and then of course you factor in not just the mental health side of the fence when you get mental health claims coming through, but also chronic pain issues with perhaps musculoskeletal conditions. And there's a really interesting study that's just come out from the University of Toronto, which goes into detail about how not only does lack of sleep influence pain, but there's, if you can improve sleep, then you can reduce pain. So that's a really interesting point. And of course, then you come up to the point to say, well, how do you improve sleep to get that effect? But I mean, when we're looking at claims, what we're trying to do is identify claims which are complex, and sleep turns out to be a great indicator for that purpose.
Wonderful. You know, I'm curious, Ian, so now that you have this information that sleep is an indicator of mental health, there's obviously its positive impact on pain management, if you can sleep, is physical health. What do you do with this finding?
That's always the big dilemma. You know, as anyone in data science knows, you know, our job is to identify what's going on. We don't have to answer the question why it's going on. But that might sound like a bit of a cop out. What kinds of interventions can we use to actually help people in this place, you know, who have got a sleep problem? When was the last time, you know, an employer asked how well you slept, you know, in terms of a wellness question to their workforce? And, you know, so if you like trying to prevent people becoming further sick. But I think there's some interesting things coming out from this research. And of course, this is all very timely because, let's face it, as perhaps your article in this morning's press indicated, people's sleep hasn't been getting better lately. And of course, you can get great medications. You know, I don't know, when I was traveling back and forth to the Far East, I used to take Ambien quite a bit, and it was fantastic. It was like the lights went out and they came on again. It was a fantastic a source of great sleep. But of course, it's highly addictive, and there's a huge temptation to over-medicate sleep medications in the same way we see the same thing happening with pain medication. And you know, trying to actually understand what the alternative is. What actually could help people in this situation, rather than just writing out another prescription, is a really interesting topic.
Interesting you mentioned that. Yeah, about the medication and everything. One of the other things that jumped out at me from that second webinar I had mentioned, the University of Arizona guy, he said all these various, medical groups, you know, physicians, sleep doctors and whatnot, you take a look at their treatment guidelines or whatever. Recently, they have shifted in the direction of prioritizing the number one intervention as cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And I've heard you mention that as well. So they're kind of prioritizing that over pharmaceutical interventions, which I think is like that's extraordinary. Especially, you know, in view of some of this other stuff, you know, I've been reading over the last couple of years, use of CBT for pain management and the like. You know, very interesting. Now, I know you've mentioned a couple of times, you know, some stuff you've done on that. So I'd be kind of interested in your perspective.
By the way, and that's great, Fred. I just want to ask you both, one or the other, Ian, if the question's being pitched to you. Just for the sake of the audience, can you explain what cognitive behavioral therapy is first?
Right. Okay. Well, basically, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is a process by which you use non-medical methods to teach an individual coping skills. It's really for things like depression and anxiety, and it's basically an educational process to go through teaching people how to come to terms with their anxiety and their depression without taking medication, which is the crucial thing. So if you like, it's often used in a self-help environment to educate people why they get depressed and what they should do when they get depressed, why people get anxious and what to do when you feel anxiety and so forth. And the CBTI piece, the insomnia piece, is an extension to this, specifically around how to improve your sleep. We're seeing it used both cognitive behavioral therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia used much more widespread in Canada than we are in the U.S. I don't know why that is. Perhaps that's another topic we can explore. But in Canada, we have a few of our clients who are using CBTI programs. On claimants that we've identified as having a sleep problem, a mental health problem, where this sort of CBTI process would actually help them out. And it's very interesting because basically, as you probably gather, it focuses on things like meditation and teaching people to have a different outlook on their sleep, and it's what they call sleep hygiene. And what is it they define? The bed is for two things: sleep and sex. And when you get to my age, you're probably just focused on the sleep now, anyway. So, but it's not for watching TV or reading texts or reading the morning newspaper or social media. You know, the technique is a lot of this, like mindful meditation, is to try and block out the feelings and thoughts that stop you sleeping. And relaxation training. Diet is important, obviously caffeine, but alcohol too. Alcohol lets you go to sleep very quickly, but it doesn't give you the best night's sleep. So things like that, which seem pretty obvious, but actually when you sort of connect everything together, and I'm not suggesting for one moment if you've got pain that feels like a red hot poker's being pressed to your back, you can't meditate the pain away. But if you could actually educate sufferers on some of these techniques, so they don't need quite such strong prescription drugs, then maybe we're making real progress. If you can lower the level of medication people on, then I think it is perhaps a really, really good thing to help people overcome such things.
Just jumping in here, CBT, like I agree with your characterization. Interestingly, in my previous life, I had been involved for a number of years in a faith-based ministry where people basically provided lay, peer support counseling, and the person who was running this had actually done some work and took up residency at the Albert Ellis Institute in New York, and Albert Ellis being one of the he and I'm blanking out on the other person who kind of invented or stumbled upon the concept of CBT at around the same time. So they're one of the premier centers, and he actually, as an experiment, took a bunch of us who were involved in that program and took us to Albert Ellis and get some further grounding in basic principles of CBT for lay people. So it is basically about noticing your thoughts and how you respond to situations, and It keeps on reminding me of that, and of course I have to blank out right now, Under Pressure, right? The line in Hamlet where there is, not this, that, or the other, but thinking makes it so. So, they have a model in there where, you have to be aware of, like, okay, what happened? If you're feeling distressed or whatever, what was the activating event? What was the belief system that kicked in that caused you to, the consequence to respond in a certain way, and then to dispute that and look at it from a a more rational, logical basis. But, you know, it is extraordinary how, you know, how much of this this kind of process can apply to, you know, so many other aspects of our lives and of our mental health, self-care, and even extending into the physical realm. And to your point, Ian, about, you know, meditation and the like, a lot of the, you know, the focus on the mindfulness is again, you know, awareness of, you know, what am I doing? You know, what am I experiencing? How am I thinking about this? It's just a, you know, fascinating concept. But, you know, again, I find it really, really interesting that, you know, this kind of technique, you can apply it to solving or, you know, putting it to use in remediating some of your fundamental sleep and insomnia problems.
You know, as I listen to both of you, and thank you for that Albert Ellis analogy, Fred, you know, I think of, you know, work that when we speak of John, you know, mindfulness, we always think of John Kabat-Zinn, who, you know, probably did the most work, you know, I hate using this term, that had a scientific overlay, right, in how to teach people, to use his terminology, to stay in the present moment, you know, to focus on your breathing and just let thoughts come and go, but not focus on them and come back to that present moment. And his research, granted, not specifically related to sleep, but related very often to pain associated with chronic health conditions, found that people actually could indeed live with their pain much better, function for a much longer period of time, live, you know, pain-free, and then in turn sleep for a longer period of time. So it feels like we've got these little pockets of work that have been done, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy extended to insomnia. When you think about it, Ian, and Fred as well, as researchers and people who work in data all the time, when you think about working with employers or with insurance carriers who are receiving claims that revolve around this, I know it's in its infancy, but Ian, it sounds like you've got some people who are already starting to experiment with this idea of getting people involved, particularly in Canada, around CBTI. Are you starting to see any translation into disability claim experience?
Yeah, I mean, that is, of course, the $6 million question. You know, and we've just actually launched a new sleep questionnaire to fit inside the other psychosocial pieces we do. So, you know, as soon as someone registers with a sleep problem, we have a drill down and we can collect a whole bunch of extra data. And as we collect that data, we're going to get some really interesting correlations emerging. You know, so at what point, you know, first of all, I guess get an understanding of what people think insomnia is all about. You know, how many hours of sleep are they actually getting? Are they taking medication for it? Is it prescription medication? And so forth. So it unfolds so we can get just a much clearer definition on what people mean by lack of sleep. And as we collect more data, we'd obviously very keen to share it with you and get some, share the insights we learned from that. But as I say, it's interesting, I mentioned it earlier on. So you know, what point do employers, you know, in perhaps in the scenario of employee assistance programs, perhaps, you know, get an understanding for how well their workforce is sleeping. So, you know, if we're saying that lack of sleep rolls into other issues and perhaps eventually results in a disability insurance claim, surely it's cost beneficial for employers to understand more about what's going on with their workers. You know, how they are sleeping, how they're coping with workplace stress and so forth, how their domestic life stress is influencing what's going on, because surely that's got to be an investment if you really believe that your workforce is your greatest asset and all that sort of stuff. So this can go, and we're seeing this more and more in disability claims management. You know, what we're trying to do is use the data to push back up the cycle, so we know the effect that sleep has on you know, downstream on what's going to happen with a claim. Then what can we do to help people who are struggling with that at an earlier stage? And you know, we're moving into away from just using techniques to detect what's going on in the data to say, okay, let's now prevent that from occurring in the first place. But I mean, you know, it's I'm you know, it's a great example where we're in a situation where the data has outstripped the process. You know, so we're now seeing what's going on from the data. We never expected to see this. We never expected to have that much influence on the claim duration, but it clearly does. Now we've got to help the insurance companies actually get their interventions and their processes up to speed on how to handle a claim when it comes in like this, and when all the indicators are, we have a problem here. What can we do?
So Ian, do you envision, if you aren't doing it already, seeing that if someone gets a certain score on the sleep section of your questionnaires, that they would be flagged as a claim that potentially could be complex or longer in duration because of that?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And you know, and therefore.
And so now we're working on the what do you do about it thing, kind of thing, right? Yeah.
But you then route that claim through to a workflow queue that says, okay, let's get this person some help, let's get this individual some assistance, you know, CBT, CBTI, whatever we feel is appropriate for that person at that time. But yes, flagging these things at an early as possible has to be the right approach.
And you know, just to build on that you know, it's essential for managing disability claims to start looking at some, you know, some other fundamental aspects of the claimant's life, like you were saying, Ian, you know, getting a handle on extent and quality of sleep, you know, doing things like the, you know, psychosocial factors, psychological screening, you know, doing something as simple as, you know, the PHQ or GAD, and these are, you know, screening instruments that, you know, everybody who goes through a Medicare checkup will be asked these questions. So if it's good enough for us old folks, then, you know, it should work on the claimant end. But beyond that, you know, there's, you know, individual interventions or whatever that, you know, will work and are appropriate for the individual claimant. But so often, and what has struck me about, you know, the various, you know, webinar content that I've heard and you know, talk about the dimensions of sleep, there's also very strong organizational impact and even, you know, social dimensions. You know, what kind of community does somebody live in, you know, social supports and the like. So, you know, people's health is being affected by so many factors. And sometimes we might find that the kind of intervention is one that, you know, the employer may have to ask itself, you know, is there something in the way we are structured and our, you know, our operations model or whatever that is kind of driving people in this particular direction. And that's where it gets interesting and that's where it can get really thorny. But it's something
yes,
that has
and,
to be looked
at. Yes, and Fred, I'd add that we both have worked on different sides of the workers' compensation issue, you from the insurance side, me from the healthcare side. And we know that people, for example, who do shift work, you know, have always struggled with circadian rhythm and sleep and health and pain management and so on. So this has flown by, and I just want to do a little call for time. We're a little under 2 minutes. So as both of you, and I'll start with you, Ian, as you know, you think as we close down this conversation, I'm going to add for now, what do you want to make sure people take away from what we just talked about?
Well, I suppose the fundamental thing, of course, is that bed is for sleep and sex and nothing else.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot to be said for that. And how about you, Fred? How, you know, when you think about if there's one thing you want to make sure people are clear on, what would that be?
Just, you know, to be awareness, be aware of your sleep patterns. You know, ask yourself, you know, how might this be interacting with some other issues that I'm experiencing? In terms of practical sleep hygiene techniques, let me throw one more into that, and that's the, I guess, the 25-minute rule. If you should be, you know, it takes you more than 25 minutes to fall asleep, or if you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't fall back asleep more than 25 minutes, get out of bed. Get out of bed, do something else. You know, go downstairs, read, listen to music or whatever, but don't lie in bed counting sheep for more than 25 minutes.
No matter what the old songs would say. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for bringing this conversation to us and really for making the offer to talk about it more. Thank you so much. Ian Bridgman and Fred Schott. And to the listeners, thank you so much for being here, continuing to listen and support. There will be a transcript and show notes available for this coming from the CDA blog post. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Bye-bye.